Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Friday, June 24th, 2022. This is the 16th edition of the AFP Report, a podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, as well as other special guests. Please consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Subscription details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. Today, I am joined by Mark Anderson, a longtime contributor to American Free Press, who also serves as the roving editor. Mark and I will be discussing the latest issue of the newspaper, issue 27 and 28, which is being printed and mailed to subscribers today. All right, Mark Anderson, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
Pretty well, John.
Good, yeah. Thanks for joining me once again. You are back to discuss the latest issue of American Free Press. We just wrapped it up yesterday, and it is being sent to the printer today. Should be mailed next Monday, and this is issue 27 and 28. And you've contributed, I think, three pieces in this issue. I've got a couple in here as well, including the front page article, which is dealing with a very potentially explosive story about two former military members who were captured in Ukraine by Russian forces and some of their pro-Russian allies in the Donbass People's Republics. A man named Alexander Dwerki, I believe is how you pronounce his last name, and then a man named Andy Huynh. And Alexander was, from what I've read, he served two tours in Iraq in the U.S. Army. And then Andy was actually in the U.S. Marine Corps stationed in Japan. And from what I've been able to read online, he's basically involved in logistics for the U.S. Marines. I don't think he ever saw any combat. So these guys have a pretty interesting background. I have no idea what the heck they think they were doing in Ukraine. Again, from what I've been able to read, it seems like they were very much influenced by the pro-Ukrainian, anti-Russian propaganda that's been spewed by the mainstream mass media from day one, you know, leading up to and, of course, throughout this conflict. So I thought this was a very interesting story. Again, potentially pretty explosive situation. There have been rumors of foreign fighters operating in Ukraine, you know, going back to the beginning of the conflict. And the Russians and their allies in the eastern part of Ukraine and in the Donbass, they've actually captured some foreign fighters, including a couple British mercenaries. And there was another guy from Morocco who was also a mercenary serving, basically operating on behalf of the Ukrainian government. And these three guys were caught just earlier this month, and they were actually sentenced to death in a court in the Donbass. And could that be the fate of these two former U.S. military members for what they were up to in Ukraine? They apparently were engaged in combat against the Russians and against the forces of the Donbass People's Republic. And this guy, Andy, actually admitted to firing a rocket-propelled grenade towards a Russian tank. Apparently it missed. There's still an ongoing investigation into what exactly these guys were up to. I've also read that they were basically operating on behalf of the SBU, which is the Ukrainian secret police. And from what they told RT, they actually were interviewed by RT, and they basically said that they were providing cover for a retreat of, you know, Ukrainian regular armed forces. And, you know, it was chaotic. You know, of course, you know, you hear from any of these guys that are actually serving in Ukraine or that are attempting to serve in Ukraine, any of these foreign mercenaries, and they all say basically the same thing. It's very corrupt. It's very disorganized and chaotic, and nobody knows what's going on. Nobody's trained. Nobody has the proper weaponry or equipment. So it sounds like just a total disaster, a total mess over there. And that's pretty much what these guys told RT once they were captured and actually interviewed. Did you have any comments on this? I don't know how closely you followed this story or if you have any thoughts on the matter.
A little bit, John. Yeah, I didn't write this one. Point of clarity, it's an AFP staff article. And it is interesting. It seems a little unrealistic in a way that they would be granted an interview once they're in captivity. Of course, RT has a little bit more of a connection to the Russian government, I believe, through funding. So maybe that would explain it. At any rate, this is part and parcel. It reminds me of a movie called State of Play, starring Russell Crowe. And Be- Ben Affleck is in the movie, and one of the main themes or revelations in the movie is that there is a whole range of private outfits that are fighting private wars, and that mercenary fighting is a big business. And so when you look at something like this from the broad view, you wonder, are these guys just loose cannons and they have this, you know, major conscience and they want to free Ukraine from the grip of the Russian bear, and they're over there on their own steam, their own, their own accord? Or are they part of some sort of NATO operation where NATO might subcontract, or the U.S. government might subcontract with private entities that hire people like this precisely to do things like this? And maybe that will come out later, but it makes you wonder, are they freelancers or are they working for private companies?
Right. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I was just going to say really quickly that that's such a good point. And it doesn't really make any sense. I mean, why would these guys are middle-aged. I've also read that Alexander Dwerki, the guy that served in the U.S. Army, he did a couple tours in Iraq that I mentioned previously. His mother was quoted as saying that he suffered from PTSD. He was struggling to hold down a job prior to going over to Ukraine. I mean, what are these guys thinking? I mean, what would motivate them just to spend their own money, apparently, and fly to Ukraine and attempt to join? They apparently attempted to join an international legion, which has, you know, been reported on, not just these guys, but people from all over, people from France, fighters from Poland and in other parts of Europe have attempted to join this international legion. And they were explaining to RT that this legion was just, not organized at all. It was, basically total chaos, as I sort of already explained. And they ended up leaving this international legion and joining another sort of like, and that's the thing. It's like, I'm not sure exactly if it's like a private military contractor and they're actually getting paid. I mean, that's what I would assume. But it's going to be interesting what's going to come out of this investigation. The Russians are, openly saying that they're going to stand trial for their crimes, and they're pursuing an investigation. And there's no guarantees that they, won't be, held accountable, including the death penalty for what they were up to in Ukraine. So it's going to be interesting. That they were specifically describing them as soldiers of fortune who were engaged in illegal activities in Ukraine. I mean, they were actively engaged in combat. So, they're not going to be subjected to the Geneva Conventions because they're not, regular armed forces. These are essentially foreign mercenaries.
Yeah, you're right. It is going to be interesting what unfolds. I think some of those private organizations who probably get tax dollars from governments to do certain operations that governments would like to have plausible deniability for. In other words, some of the messy or more clandestine operations, governments in the strict sense probably want to keep their hands clean and have deniability. So it's certainly plausible that they might hire these private soldier of fortune companies. I'm going back in my memory a little bit. I think one was called Executive Outcomes, and there was another one. What was that called? I think they changed the name to XI.
There was remember like Black, what was it? Blackwater, I think
was the big one.
Yeah, going back to like the invasion of Iraq. And these guys were, getting paid millions of dollars, the company anyways. And they were doing all sorts of very, very shady things.
Right.
A lot of very illegal things from what I remember. And this seems to be part and parcel of modern warfare, at least, when America's involved.
Right. Now, people are already accusing, probably rightly so, that Ukraine itself is a Western proxy state. Ukraine seems to be, and my understanding isn't as deep as it could be, but it seems to be a state that's not quite a state in a way. It seems like ever since it was overthrown in terms of the pro-Russian president, Yanukovych, I think you say his name, in February of 2014, and there was that fake uprising that apparently was CIA orchestrated, and Victoria Nuland was involved with Yatsenyuk. They called him Yats, and they were involved in changing the nature of the Ukrainian government to a pro-Western, pro-EU, pro-NATO model, it seems like it's kind of floating in some sort of never-never land. In other words, it's not quite part of the Western governmental structure or rules-based international order altogether. It seems like it's tentatively that, but not officially that. I maybe I'm mistaken, but that's the way it looks and smells. And it seems like leader, Zelensky, he just strikes me as someone who's just sort of a token president, not really officially. Yeah, and so he's there to just mind the store while they go through some sort of transition. I feel like, based on past experiences and past things I've looked into, that they're going to try and use this to leverage Ukraine all the way into the NATO-EU mold, which was probably the intent of the overthrow in February of 2014 anyway. And so they would therefore probably provoke Russia. And I'm not saying Putin is a angel. None of these people are angels. But I think Putin is more rational than Zelensky. And I think he is a little bit more common sense than Zelensky. And I think that they probably provoked Russia in order to provide a pretext to then move Ukraine out of the Russian orbit into the NATO orbit, because all NATO has ever done, as you know, John, is move eastward and either officially consume countries on the Russian border or at least sway them away from Russia ideologically. And so NATO always plays the victim when it is geographically, definitely geopolitically, it is the aggressor. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And this is, you know, this is something that's been going on since the fall of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. And this is something that Putin has openly talked about in all of his major speeches. You know, he was hammering this point, you know, leading up to this conflict, leading up to the invasion, leading up to the quote unquote special military operation. And this is a point that I make in the article. I mean, you know, the U.S. and their puppets and the EU and NATO and Ukraine, they have been hypocritically lecturing Putin and the Russians about this quote-unquote rules-based international order, and they're the primary violators of the rules-based international order, whether it's the invasion of Afghanistan or Iraq or, you know, what they did in Libya, what they've done in all these countries in the Middle East. And even including Ukraine, for that matter. You know, you mentioned the 2014 Maidan Revolution. I mean, this was basically a CIA-sponsored color revolution in the Ukraine designed to destabilize the country, designed to draw the country away from Russia. And, you know, that's basically exactly what's happened. And it's led to this ongoing sort of civil war that has played out in the eastern part of Ukraine. And it's come to this, and this is the primary. This to me is the main reason why we're here at this point, is because Ukraine and the Western powers that have manipulated Ukraine, they are the ones that have rejected international agreements such as the Minsk Accords, which were negotiated after, you know, in the aftermath of the Maidan Revolution and the beginning of the civil war taking place in eastern Ukraine.
Right.
They're the ones that failed to uphold the key pillars of the Minsk Accords. And they've basically just rejected any sort of respectable standards of international diplomacy, of, you know, international law in general. And yet they're the ones that hypocritically lectured the Russians all the time about violating the rules-based international order. I mean, it's total hypocrisy on display, and it's blatant right in your face. And it appears now that the Russians are the ones that are actually, you know, sticking to international agreed upon, you know, legislation and treaties and in their treatment of these people that they're capturing, these foreign mercenary fighters that they're capturing.
Yeah, the creators of the international rules-based order, the Western Alliance, the Transatlantic Alliance, you know, it involves the what became the World Trade Organization. This was all hatched at Bretton Woods at the Mount Washington Hotel in New Hampshire in the summer of 1944, before World War II was actually over. And they had that major summit there. They called it Bretton Woods, and they created the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. The Marshall Plan had just consummated. And the idea was is that there'd be no more nation-on-nation wars. And they believe they've achieved that, that there'd be no more major world wars. Well, what actually happened was they got rid of declared wars. After World War II, the U.S. has never fought an officially declared war ever since then. Korea was actually a United Nations-operated war, and it was a disaster. So they didn't eliminate war. They just eliminated a traditional model of war, and then everything became police actions, undeclared wars, clandestine operations, subterranean operations.
Cover revolutions, color revolutions, yeah, like destabilization operations.
Right, and these, and then the creation of these private mercenary outfits that maybe they're modeled a little bit on the old French Foreign Legion, but there's a whole range of them. Don't kid yourself. There's probably 3, 4, 5 dozen of them. There could be several hundred for all I know, but there's a lot of them, and they are for profit. They have probably shareholders, as I understand it, and people are called, and they put their gun in a case, just like a guitar player going to a gig would put his guitar in a case, and they go, where do I go? And they get their list of who or what to shoot, and they're paid, and it's a gig.
Right. Yeah.
That's how it works.
Right. Well, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's what these guys were up to in Ukraine. And as I mentioned, the Russians and their allies in the Donbass have already captured foreign fighters just earlier this month. They actually tried three of them that I mentioned, the two British citizens and then one Moroccan. And they were found guilty of taking action toward a violent overthrow of power. They were captured near Mariupol, which was the scene of very heavy fighting for much of this conflict thus far. The Russians and their allies in the east, in the eastern part of Ukraine, have basically taken over the city at this point. But you know, there was rumors about foreign fighters involved in this, you know, going back to the beginning of the conflict. And sure enough, it turns out that there indeed were foreign fighters involved, and the Russians have captured them. And they were found guilty of basically, as I mentioned, attempting to overthrow the government there, and involved, they were involved in terroristic activities. And they're sentenced to death after you know, a court hearing. And you know, that I have a feeling that that's gonna be the fate of these two American mercenaries, essentially.
Right. I would caution that we don't necessarily want to believe everything they say on the Russian side in terms of the allegations. But what we can say with a lot of confidence is that we should not be fighting private wars through private individuals or private organizations, because that can be taken to mean, on the other side, they might interpret that as just a slightly thinly veiled attack by the U.S. government itself on Russian assets that might spill over into Russia proper. So can you trust these loose cannons, these privateers, to stick to the agenda, to stick to their paid assignments? And if they're strictly freelance without any backing, I would find that hard to believe, because it would be a major sacrifice of your time and probably your life and certainly your health to go do this just out of idealism without any financial or ideological backing. I would find that very difficult to believe, that they care so much for Zelensky and Ukraine that they're putting it all on the line. And that, you know, that would be very noble in a sense, but it, you know, noble can still be stupid, right?
Yeah. Oh, no. I totally agree. I have a very hard time believing anybody, no matter how noble or righteous they think they were acting, would just fly to a foreign country, you know, on their own dime and participate in a war, risk their life. There's no way. I mean, these guys had to have been getting paid somehow, some way. I'm not sure exactly the details. I don't think anybody knows the details at this point. Hopefully, you know, that is determined and reported on. But it's interesting. I mean, in this, in their interview with RT, they were basically saying that they were admitting that they were misled and even going to Ukraine in the first place, and that they were only getting one side of the story. And when they got there, they realized that there's actually two sides to to the story in this conflict, and we've basically only been fed the pro-Ukrainian side. which is pretty interesting. And this guy was basically warning both these guys in their interview with RT were basically warning other potential foreign fighters thinking about coming to Ukraine to fight on behalf of the Ukrainians to think twice about what they were doing, because it's not all it's cracked up to be, essentially, is what they were saying.
Yeah, let me interject there. That does suggest, it doesn't prove by any means, but it does suggest that maybe they're not there strictly on their own dime, their own time, but it does suggest they have some freedom of judgment here and that they're not under some employer's heavy thumb saying you can only repeat a certain line, you can't reveal the truth about this. So they felt they were free to speak out in the way you just described, John. It does sound to me like maybe they deserve a little leniency because they went in there maybe without both eyes open and didn't really know the truth. And certainly, even though they might have acted irrationally or impulsively or irresponsibly, I hope they're not sentenced to death, despite their misjudgments, despite their zeal, whatever the case. We can hope and pray that that there's leniency for them, because that gives me a little bit of sympathy toward them, personally speaking, because you and I both know that same thing, right? That we're not getting the whole truth. And imagine we're in their position. You get there and you're thinking, it could be any number of things. One of the things I believe is I don't think the fighting is as large scale as we're told. I think it's much more surgical. I don't personally believe that Putin would bomb a hospital. There would be no rational reason to use the time and the materiel and the expense, the ordnance, to just go bombing hospitals and stuff like that. Some of that might be ginned up or theater that's been cooked up. You've done some articles, John, about some of the fakery going on over there, or exaggeration, yeah, or misdirection. I think based on what I know, based on Putin's speeches, he would be much more surgical about this and much more item by item, and only shoot at what he has to shoot at. I mean, I really don't think that's... they're just going to just bomb hospitals. So therefore, I think they get there and they see that, wait a minute, maybe Russia wears the white hats and Ukraine wears the black hats. Maybe they both wear black hats, but whatever they're seeing, it's not what they thought it would be.
Yes, absolutely.
And imagine being in that position. It's like, whoa, why did I sign up for this? Or why did I think that was a good idea? So hopefully there'll be leniency based on them seeing the truth, whatever exactly the truth is. But the other half of it, besides my belief that the fighting is much lower scale than we're told, is that to the extent that the fighting's going on, I would not want to go up against the Russian army. They are well-fed, well-trained, well-equipped, and you're not going to beat them. You're just not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I completely agree. Well, it's interesting. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with these guys, and even with the other foreign mercenaries that have been captured. They're apparently appealing their sentence, so that's not even fully decided at this point. And who knows? I'm sure these guys, assuming they are found guilty like the previous foreign mercenaries, I'm sure that they could also appeal their sentence. So we'll see what happens. I definitely thought it was an interesting story. And there's actually, if you go to AmericanFreePress.net, there's actually a longer version of the front page article in this current issue, providing some more details about the background of these guys and in the situation. So I'd encourage people to check out the website as well. Well, let's go ahead and move on. Let's go ahead and move on. I want to cover one other story I wrote for this issue, and then we can talk about some of the articles that you put together. And this is, again, a topic that I've been covering for a number of years for American Free Press, and that is this total anarcho-tyranny we see in the United States that's basically taken over the entire country at this point, at least to a large extent, where total criminals, especially far-left, radical, Antifa terrorists, Black Lives Matter people, and even, black criminals, frankly, are totally let off the hook for their violent crimes. Meanwhile, regular average Americans are prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, especially if you're a conservative. I mean, look what's happening with the whole January 6th situation. I mean, the double standards are just so ridiculous and in your face. And this week I covered a situation in Philadelphia. There was three basically admitted, openly acknowledged members of Antifa, a man named Thomas Massey, Thomas Keenan, and Joseph Alkoff. And they were charged back in 2018 with multiple felony charges. They basically confronted, it was these three and then, you know, a larger group of their Antifa supporters, their Antifa, you know, a network basically of a bunch of Antifa people were at a protest. There was a couple U.S. Marines that were just walking around the area. They weren't even involved in anything. They weren't involved in the protest. They were basically there to just to check out the city. They were just visiting Philadelphia for the weekend to attend a Marine ball. These guys were active duty U.S. Marines, and both of them were Hispanic. And the Antifa people saw these two individuals walking around, and they confronted them, and were basically accusing them of being Proud Boys, accusing them of being white supremacists, despite the fact that one of them was Mexican. The other one, I'm not sure what his ethnic background was, but both of them have Hispanic last names. And these guys were caught. Yeah, these guys were caught and arrested. They had pepper sprayed these two Marines, active duty Marines. Pepper sprayed them. They jumped them. They were punching them in the head, kicking them. I mean, it really was a totally violent, unprovoked assault. These three were arrested for the crimes. And recently, in proceedings, they were allowed to plead guilty to simple misdemeanors. And basically have been let off the hook for attacking two U.S. Marines. So even U.S. Marines are not safe on the streets of America with these, you know, far-left Soros-funded district attorneys, and that's exactly what's going on in Philadelphia. The local district attorney is a man named Larry Krasner, a Jewish far-left district attorney that everybody, I mean, even in these left-wing strongholds like San Francisco and Los Angeles, everybody is so sick and tired of these ideologically driven far-left district attorneys that are just failing to enforce the rule of law. The district attorney in San Francisco, Chesa Boudin, who is actually tied in with the Weather Underground, if you can believe it or not. His family was, his mother and his father were involved in the Weather Underground.
My goodness.
And I mean, that's like a legitimate, like, known terrorist organization, far left terrorist organization. And this man was elected the district attorney, and he was just recalled because he's done such a poor job, and San Francisco is a total dump. And, you know, you can't even walk down the street without getting attacked or mugged or accosted by a homeless drug addict. I mean, it's like a third world country out there nowadays. And it was, you know, once one of the most beautiful, you know, financial centers on the West Coast. I mean, like the top city on the West Coast, essentially.
Yes. You're painting a really disturbing picture, John. Interesting. Yeah, a little personal note. I went to a Benton Harbor, Michigan church about 9 years ago because there was a protest. I'm coming at this from kind of an oblique angle. There was a protest regarding the Battle Creek Army Base, Fort Custer, I believe, in Battle Creek, Michigan, just south of Lansing. And the protest was because they were putting in a drone operation station there where soldiers would operate drones anywhere in the world. And a lot of the protesters ended up at a Benton Harbor church. And I went in there. I like to share personal stories once in a while. And I was talking to this lady. I think her name was Kathy Kelly or Karen Kelly. And we were talking about some of the people having come from Chicago, from South Chicago. And I said, oh, that's interesting. That's kind of, you know, where a lot of the Chicago power brokers and their minions are, you know. And I mentioned Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, who are of Weather Underground fame. I said, yeah, they'd probably take an interest in this. She goes, that's interesting because they're right behind you.
Wow.
And I turned around in the flesh. There he was, William Ayers and Bernadine Dorn. I kid you not. And I spoke with him kind of obliquely. He was a very intelligent, although kind of nervous guy. And we talked a little bit about Obama. I didn't reveal that I was AFP. Because when something like that happens, the first rule of thumb is you want to know more about them than they know about you, right? So I was kind of oblique about who I was or what I was affiliated with, and I was more of just an interested citizen. I sort of agreed with the drone base. And in fact, I actually did agree with some of what he said about protesting the drone base going into Battle Creek's Army base. But I kept things kind of at arm's length and spoke to him a little bit. And we talked about this and that. Bernadine Dorn was an odd person. She is kind of like Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina senator. She has that 10-mile stare. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah. Kind of like not focused, kind of staring off into the distance.
Yeah, as someone who you never feel like is looking at you.
Right,
like you look
right.
at it, it's, they're always looking past you. I call it the 10-mile stare, which is a frequent expression. But at any rate, I bring this up because the Weather Underground, of course, back in Bill Ayer's heyday, and he of course, was heavily involved in leading the Weather Underground, and yet he ended up as a tenured professor who achieved tenure. I believe it was at the University of Illinois at Champlain, Champaign, or that town in Illinois. What's that?
I think it's Champaign, Illinois. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Pardon me. Yeah. The University of Illinois at Champaign. And so he was a tenured professor. That was his punishment for being Weather Underground, which suggests to me he might have been a CIA operative all along. And the idea may have been to use that to stir up trouble from the left-hand side of the political spectrum in order to provoke laws that would come down on everybody. The old Hegelian dialectic, create a problem, create a solution, and then everybody's worse off, right?
Yeah.
So because they tried to, I believe they did bomb an army base or an army dance. I believe, without looking it up, I believe the Weather Underground was involved in setting off bombs not only at landmarks, but at an army base where there was a dance. And so they were involved in attacking soldiers themselves. And now you're talking about, you know, connections to the Weather Underground still to this day and attacks on Marines. See, so the more that things change, the more they stay the same. I'm sharing very broad brushstrokes here, but I like to put in personal experiences when I can to kind of dissect what's going on. But it's a really provocative thing to have something that serious attack Marines like that and then do nothing about it. To me, they're just trying to provoke a response that then they can then use that response to enact even more of their ideological revolution. This authoritarian system of the U.S., it's persecuting these misunderstood Antifa members who might act a little out of line, but their heart's in the right place because they see so many injustices. And then if you come down on them and you prosecute them, then they turn up the heat even more.
Well, I can only conclude that the radical left, like the terrorist left, Antifa, Black Lives Matter, these people are protected by the state. They are foot soldiers in this revolution to overthrow every aspect of traditional American society, to totally destroy the concept of America as a unique Western nation. And these people are protected at every step of the way. And this has been going on certainly for the past 10 years at least. These guys, two of them, Keenan and Macy, two of the guys that attacked these U.S. Marines, they were originally charged with felony aggravated assault and conspiracy charges, along with several other misdemeanor charges. And one of them, Keenan, was actually charged with a felony count of ethnic intimidation because he was using derogatory language towards these individuals, calling them, a wetback and a spick and things like this. Once they basically said, look, what are you talking about? We're not white supremacists, we're Mexicans. And so, I mean, it's just incredible how charges of this nature, like very serious felony charges, could simply be dropped And, you know, they were basically allowed to plead guilty to a simple assault, a misdemeanor, resulting in probation. I mean, it's almost unbelievable, but that's the level of anarchic tyranny we're seeing in America these days. And again, I can only conclude that these people and their allies are literally protected by the state and allowed and encouraged to commit crimes like this.
Yeah, it's almost as if these are the mercenaries in the domestic realm, just as the people arrested in Ukraine are mercenaries in the international geopolitical realm. It seems like they both perform a similar function to create unrest, to create instability in pursuit of higher political aims. I don't think I'm stepping too far out of line to say that. Actually, I think with Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn and the Weather Underground and the whole Patty Hearst thing going way back, I think was the earlier renditions, the beginnings, if you will, of this kind of thing. Bill Ayers was basically yesterday's Antifa, only a little more sophisticated. And yes, they create violent acts, and they carry out violent acts to agitate for the state to then come down on everybody. And I think also part of what they did back in the early days was they co-opted the anti-war movement. There were some good elements of the anti-Vietnam War movement that were making headway. And all of a sudden, the Weather Underground and these really radical organizations come elbowing their way in. And doesn't this sound like what happened January 6th, right, in 2021? They elbow their way in and they do things that are really deadly and radical. And then it discredits the entire anti-war movement. And then everybody thinks of the anti-war movement as being violent when there were good parts of it that were displaced and discredited. And I think this is also a part of this. They don't want any unity in the American populace. They don't want any, the actual symbol of fascism, right, is a bundle of reeds wrapped together with an axe in it, right? What do they call that? Fascists?
The fascists, yep.
Yeah, that signifies unity. It's nothing evil or sinister. It's just been mislabeled. They don't want that. They want that bundle of reeds to always be broken. And so a lot of what this serves is simple disunity and a kind of chaotic landscape where nobody can agree on anything, and the country can't unite in certain areas and clean up what's going on, get rid of the debt-based money system, get rid of the mass media cartel, and get our financial house in order, and so on and so forth. So these kind of revolutionaries serve a lot of purposes for their George Soros type bosses and their Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation bosses, and other financiers that are often behind these kind of organizations. Because how many people, just like these soldiers of fortune over in Ukraine, how many of these Antifa people could survive on their own, traveling from city to city to city, from hotel to youth hostel to youth hostel, from Starbucks latte to Starbucks latte, and eating and having to eat and everything and survive? How many of them could survive without sponsors, just like the Soldiers of Fortune, right? So
yeah,
it's almost like
exactly.
we're looking at two kinds of Soldiers of Fortune here.
Yeah, right. No, that's a very good point. And one thing, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with Andy Ngo. We actually sell his book at American Free Press about Antifa. He covers Antifa extremely well. He's like that. That's like pretty much his beat. But I remember reading his book, and he describes how Antifa is really like a very, very well organized, very, very well coordinated, and it's seemingly well funded type organization. And yet we don't see any calls for federal authorities, local authorities, to actually investigate these people who, again, have committed blatant acts of criminality and outright terrorism, I would describe it as. Meanwhile, you know, you look at what's happening with January 6th. You look at what's speaking of January 6th, Don Jeffries had a couple really good articles about January 6th in this current issue of the newspaper, including one about he was a former head coach in the NFL. Now he's an assistant. I think he's actually the defensive coordinator for they used to be called the Washington Redskins. What are they now? The Washington Commanders, I think. I'm not even sure.
Wait a second. You mean they got rid of the name Redskins?
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, that's part of the whole woke nonsense that we see now. What are they called? I think it is the Washington Commanders. I'm going to look it up really quick.
I got to make a brief one-sentence comment on that. The name Washington Redskins was never a pejorative. It's not a put-down. It's a way of expressing honor and paying homage to the Native American. In fact, it is a way of expressing appreciation for them. It was never and could never have been a put-down, a pejorative, or a way of making fun of them. Anybody that thinks otherwise is literally out of their gourd.
They
have no concept what they're talking about. Period. Paragraph.
Yeah, it's really insane. I mean, this is the state of America, you know, in 2022. I think they actually changed their name a couple years ago. It's been a couple years that they've been the Washington Commanders. Anyways, Jack Del Rio, who I think is their defensive coordinator, he made some very minor comments about January 6th, basically referring to it as a dust-up and sort of contrasted it to, you know, all of 2020, all the violence and terrorism and looting and pillaging we saw at the hands of the Black Lives Matter and Antifa terrorists in virtually every single major American city across the country. And was basically pointing out the double standards. And boy, did he have to walk that back almost immediately. He was demonized in the press. The team came after him. The head coach, lectured him and made him didn't make him apologize, but, you know, basically he was forced to apologize to keep his job. He was fined $100,000 for these very innocuous, harmless, common sense comments that, you know, probably more than half the country would agree with. And yet, you know, this shows you that there's no dissent from the prevailing far left radical narrative on any topic in this country, no matter how powerful you are, no matter how, you know, influential you are, how much money you have. I mean, they will come after you and they will force you to apologize. They will make you pay fines. There's still calls for him to be fired for these comments. I mean, it is outrageous.
Comes to mind.
Yeah.
Without a judge, without a legal decision, how was he fined? Was he penalized in terms of his pay by the
The team. Well, the team, from what I understand, the team actually fined him, and they were going to donate the money to the D.C. Metropolitan Police, who were, you know, portrayed as heroes in, you know, the whole January 6th. Situation. So yeah, it was the team that fined him.
Yeah, it's worth quickly commenting here, just because certain things about January 6th just bear repeating to make sure people get it. Number one, and above all, there absolutely was serious election anomalies, irregularities, fraud, and theft in November of 2020, unequivocally, beyond argument. It's only a question of degree, and the Voter GA group in Georgia is doing a bang-up job, Voters Organized for Trusted Election Results in Georgia, showing tens of thousands of missing ballot images, and they're having a press conference coming up this next week. Go to Voter GA, as in Georgia, voterga.org, and check out their work. It is phenomenal. Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State of Georgia, the one that's such a hero because Trump tried to get him to find votes in Trump's favor in Georgia, and he valiantly resisted Donald Trump. That whole thing is just such a dog and pony show. It is smoke and mirrors all the way. Voter GA in that press conference is going to look at the anomalies in the reelection of Brad Raffensperger himself and all the anomalies in his own reelection. And they are quite legion, I understand it. So Georgia is ground zero in many ways, stemming out of November 2020. See, so therefore, January 6th, the people that were there at the rally, does it have to be repeated? They were not there to steal the election. They were there because they felt it already had been stolen. They weren't there to overturn the results. They were there because they felt the results already were overturned. You cannot drive that home enough. And to the extent that there was any violence or trespassing, once again, these soldiers for hire in the domestic realm were bussed in there. Everybody saw it. A lot of times they wear the same shoes, even though their clothes might look different. They wear the same shoes so they can identify each other. That's been borne out by an experienced videographer who's covered protests all around the world, and he spoke to Epoch Times about that. But at any rate, they're just trying to make January 6th, this day that lives in infamy, like December 7th, 1941, like 9/11/01. Oh my God, that was the day the whole world changed. And, you know, in fact, it was a few loose cannons, a few people that made stupid idea or stupid decisions, and plus these agitators that came in. And it, a lot of unfortunate things happen. You know, human nature being what it is, once all the rules go away, sometimes chaos arises. But by and large, it was a rally against the already known theft of that election. And that's just the way it is. Check out voterga.org, and you'll see, especially in the state of Georgia, you'll see the true nature of things.
Yeah, well said. I basically agree with you, and I think that January 6th was a total setup. I think there's all sorts of evidence to demonstrate that. You look at the way it was basically set up to create a media spectacle that could be used to go after Trump supporters, basically any patriotic American, anybody that was questioning what the media and government were saying about any given topic, but certainly the result of the 2020 election. And I mean, on its face, there's just no way that Joe Biden got the most votes in any presidential election in history when the man had no support virtually anywhere in the country. I mean, anywhere he went, everybody was, you know, all you saw was Trump signs. I mean, there's no way that he had 81 million votes. It's just absurd on its face. And I basically completely agree with you. And and Don Jeffries covers the issue pretty well. We've talked about January 6th numerous times on this podcast, on other podcasts, and it's a topic we will continue to cover in the pages of American Free Press. Mark, I wanted to move on and get to the fraudulent nature of quote unquote clean energy and this, you know, green energy revolution. We had a couple really interesting stories in this current issue about this topic, including one that you wrote. Yours was more focused on electric vehicles. Chris Petherick also wrote an article dealing with solar panels and how they actually pose very serious environmental and health risks. In the manufacturing process, the chemicals that are used to manufacture these solar panels and how they're actually disposed of. You know, they can start on fire when they do need to be scrapped. I mean, it's very difficult to actually recycle them. And a lot of these companies involved in manufacturing solar panels are, you know, polluting the environment tremendously. And it's resulting in a lot of, health problems for people, especially in China and in the Far East, where a lot of these solar panels are actually manufactured. So the whole concept of clean energy is fraudulent. In virtually every single respect. Do I basically have that right?
I think so. My own experiences have been that it seems like certain clean energy applications work in limited venues. For example, there's a brewery in Ypsilanti, Michigan, near Ann Arbor. The entire roof is solar panels, and most of the building runs on so-called clean energy. And I think that in individualized cases like that, you can make it work if you build things carefully and you account for all the materials and disposal and everything. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. Maybe then they use less grid power and they're able to sell energy back to the grid. Again, nothing wrong with that. The problem seems to come, John, when you try and do these things large scale. That's when you run into a lot of problems, because then, for example, when it comes to batteries, then you have to mine a whole lot of lithium, a whole lot of cadmium, a whole lot of nickel, a whole lot of copper. And when things become large scale, that's when the problems really kick in. Then you've got that many more solar panels to dispose of.
And then mining, yes. I'm sorry, real quick, I was going to say, in mining these minerals is extremely damaging to the environment itself, right? I mean, in many cases anyways.
Oh, very, very much so. I cited the objective work of Dr. Michael Heberling, who chairs the leadership studies program at Baker College, an MBA program in Flint, Michigan, about 3.5 hours from where I'm sitting. And he's a member of the Foundation for Economic Education's faculty network. The FEE is sort of a conservative, quasi-libertarian leaning organization. But I also quote the Liberal Wilson Center and Liberal Amnesty International. See, so it's not just conservatives, it's liberals also that are pointing out everything from extremely environmentally damaging mining and access operations to get these minerals together for the batteries that run Tesla cars and that run all sorts of other popular battery-powered devices in our modern society. But they're also showcasing the fact that, and this is according to the Liberal Wilson Center, 40,000 African children in the Congo and even more adults are enslaved to mine cobalt for the clean energy revolution. So of the 255,000 Congolese people mining for cobalt, 40,000 of them are children, some as young as 6 years. And the article on page 19 of the current AFP, as you can see, John, it shows the face of one particular child, a black Congolese child. He looks to be maybe 7, 8 years old, frowning in disgust. And they're walking in a muddy, mucky area, and by hand scooping out material that evidently contains cobalt. And I could go down the list. I mean, one basic thing is 90% of the lead acid batteries for conventional internal combustion engine automobiles are recycled, 90%, but only 5% of electric vehicle lithium ion batteries are recycled. But that's just the beginning of it. Nickel, a major component of EV batteries, electric vehicle, is found just below the topsoil in the rainforests of Indonesia and the Philippines. The nickel is extracted using horizontal surface mining, resulting in extensive environmental degradation, deforestation, and the removal of the top layer of soil, which then washes off. We know that. Rainforests play a major role in, quote, fighting climate change, Dr. Michael Heberling wrote. Isn't that ironic? By removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere via photosynthesis. The environmental battle cry, save the rainforest, needs to be replaced, Heberling wrote, with a new slogan, quote, it was necessary to destroy the rainforest in order to save the planet. So you see,
That's what I mean. Like, you know, the so-called green revolution is actually harming the environment rather than saving the environment. It's so destructive and so unnecessary. And so, you know, as you sort of said, it's like a top-down approach to everything. And frankly, I'm not even convinced, you know, of the reality of quote-unquote climate change or global warming. I think this is basically a totally made-up concept. And I think that's been pretty well established at this point, in fact. And we have plenty of traditional forms of energy, oil, coal, natural gas, that could easily be extracted using very, frankly, safe and environmentally friendly ways, as long as it's done properly. And this whole idea of that we need to, you know, totally transform our society, totally transform our economy, is just this like total pipe dream, you know, cooked up by these globalists. A lot of this is coming from these globalist organizations that we've talked about so much. I mean, that's like one of the leading topics at Bilderberg, at the World Economic Forum, at, you know, pretty much all of these globalist type organizations, right? I mean, this idea of climate change and combating global warming, and how nobody can own a car, you know, in the future, and we all got to live like pack animals in like little tiny apartments, and, you know, we can't use energy and stuff like that. I mean, that's like really sort of the narrative that they promote. So this is a very elitist, top-down driven narrative and agenda none of which is based on actual science, and many of the, as you're explaining, many of the techniques used to extract a lot of these minerals and resources needed to create quote-unquote clean energy is in fact destructive to the environment to begin with.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Lithium is also extremely problematic. It's worth sharing this really quickly. And also the lithium ion batteries. Lithium extraction is a lengthy 12 to 18 month evaporation process that's water intensive. Each ton of lithium produced requires 500,000 gallons of groundwater out of the aquifers. This process can result in both water and soil contamination, plus a depleted water table. And depleted aquifers is a big problem. People don't realize even the large aquifer under Nebraska,
Ogallala Aquifer.
Yeah, the Ogallala Aquifer, which is initially, believe it or not, was thought to be nine Lake Eries, John. Nine Lake Eries in volume is now, by some estimates, thought to be half or less. But putting that aside, that one requires a little more investigation. But the real take-home on this, the takeaway is that lithium ion batteries, putting aside all the problems with mining these materials and all the damage it causes, lithium ion batteries catch fire while charging, whether they're in phones, computers, work tools, house batteries, electric vehicles. There are many instances of houses and businesses being burnt due to these fires. Lithium ion battery fires can quickly exceed 1,000 degrees centigrade, which is 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. The melting point of steel is about 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. Automobiles that have lithium ion batteries that have been involved in testing or involved in automobile accidents have burned with fires at frightening temperatures, and you cannot use conventional firefighting techniques to put them out. You cannot squirt a lithium ion battery that's on fire with water, John. You cannot squirt it with water.
Right, yeah, it's incredibly dangerous, right? I mean...
Yeah, I know for a fact that a Prius, I've been told by many mechanics that a Prius is an extremely dangerous car to perform mechanic work on. You have to make sure you disconnect certain battery lines in there or you'll be fried like a piece of bacon. This is my understanding.
Yeah, wow. No, yeah. I don't doubt it.
Yeah, so I think I would summarize this whole topic by saying you can piecemeal some of this. I've been in taxis and cabs where there's an electric motor that's backup to the gas-driven motor. And if the cabbie is busy and forgets to buy gas, he can switch over to the electric part of his car, and that will get him through the rest of the day until he gets a chance to get more gas. See, so you can use this stuff supplementally. You can use it in certain venues. I mentioned that brewery that was totally self-powered. There's nothing inherently wrong with these things. And I think that they could be applied carefully over the decades ahead. But to do it in one swell swoop, you might say. I like to say swell swoop. It's a little more humorous. To try and do it in one gulp. And to do it widespread, I think, is just going to fall right on its face for the reasons we're outlining. They're not impossible. But, you know, even with wind turbines, I've seen demonstrations of vertical axis wind turbines. Now, think of a cylinder like a pop can with fins on the side, and the cylinder is going around as the wind hits the fins. Can you picture that?
Right. Yep.
Now that's a vertical axis wind turbine. Now, that can work in some venues. These windmill-type wind turbines they have, you'll notice they're all designed the same. It's the same design everywhere. It's an inferior design. People that live near them and animals that live near them have suffered some effects. They're known as bird swatters. They're extremely onerous to transport. We've seen them on the back of those long semi-beds. And to the extent that wind power could be used, a vertical axis wind turbine, cylindrically shaped, would be absolutely superior. So you also run into other so-called green ideas that would work better, but ironically, they're not used. They only use these inferior ideas for the Green Revolution. So that's another caveat of this. So why not use the vertical axis? Why not use something that works far better? You only need about a 3 mile an hour wind to get a vertical axis wind turbine turning, whereas the average large scale wind turbines, the ones we see all over, require something in the range of 12 to 15 mile an hour winds to even really be efficiently moving at all. And what I saw at the seminar that I went to is that the average wind speed in the world is about 9 miles an hour. So if the average wind speed is 9 miles an hour and the big ones won't react very well until it's 12 or 15, but the cylindrical ones act really efficiently when it's only 3 or 4 miles an hour, you can see that another thing that happens is, to the extent they go green, they give us the worst of the options.
So, right, yeah. Well, yeah,
that's a more objective, that's an objective look at the whole thing. There you go.
Yeah, no, well said. I agree with you. And you know, this is a topic that I haven't really explored in much detail, but I found it, you know, very, very interesting. And I've always been skeptical of the whole concept of global warming anyways, and this idea of, you know, the Green Revolution. But the more I look into it, the more really outrageous it is. I mean, even like Tesla vehicles, like I think that like the cheapest one you could get is close to $50,000, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, depending on how it's set up, depending how many batteries it has, I mean, you're going to get on a full charge, I think it's less than 300 miles. So, I mean, it's just, frankly, it's just really not practical. And Paul Angel in his personal, he had some interesting statistics and information about electric vehicles and the batteries. These batteries, from what he was writing, cost minimum like $10,000 for one of them. So, I mean, imagine you have to replace your battery, you know, what, every, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 years or whatever. I mean, this is a significant chunk of change, not to mention the price of the vehicle itself. And then you got to think about how they're actually going to be recharged. You got to, like, totally, you know, set up your home differently, you know, your, like, the electric outlets and whatnot to actually charge the vehicle at home. And what toll is that taking on the electric grid? So there's a lot that's really not thought very well thought out by these proponents of, you know, quote unquote, clean energy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it strikes me as it's a political goal. In other words, make it so only the wealthy can afford to have a car at all.
Right.
And to the extent that there are cars, it would only be those kind of cars, which I understand at this point in time, and I hope I'm wrong, require about 3 hours of charging. If they're totally uncharged, you're driving along the road, you don't just gas and go like we do now, right? Oh my gosh, my charge is low. I've got to kill 2 or 3 hours while my car charges, but my mom is having medical trouble in Nebraska and I'm 400 miles away and I've got to sit here for 3 hours while this thing charges. That just ain't going to wash. And you'll notice the gas price is shooting up to make gas-powered cars more expensive. Is that really a real uptick due to market conditions, or is it political? You really have to wonder, are they trying to force us out of cars? I wrote a recent article in AFP about a British national that spoke to the annual World Bank spring meetings, and he was a former World Bank honcho there. He's a British national, and he called for the end of the internal combustion engine at the World Bank spring meeting.
Right. Well, that's what I mean. This is very much a elitist globalist agenda that they have been pushing. This is not something that average people are clamoring for, right? I mean, this is a very much elitist-driven agenda, and it always has been, frankly.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I believe you wanted to do a little bit on Uvalde, but yes, this green thing takes an objective look. We're doing it at AFP, but the mass media cartel, they just cannot give you objectivity. It just isn't going to happen.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, I definitely wanted to talk about Uvalde to kind of wrap up this podcast. And you wrote another very interesting article in this issue. I know we talked about it in the previous podcast, in the previous issue. Don Jeffries had written an article about it. You've been covering it pretty closely. It's just the more and more I look into this situation, the more and more bizarre it is. I mean, there's so many unanswered questions, so many red flags. I have a hard time believing or accepting any of this at face value. It seems like now, I mean, you can kind of talk about it in more detail, but the local officials, the police department, they are hesitant to release any public records, any information about the situation. It's extremely bizarre. None of it really adds up. What you want to talk about your latest findings?
Yeah, I think a concise way of describing this, John, would be there's a lot of omission. Naturally, there's two things the mass media cartel does. Commission, where they write things knowingly or unknowingly that are simply wrong or misleading, or omission, where they simply don't discuss anything at all that's very pertinent. And I would start with the omission. And some of the things I have in the article are very compelling. But there's one thing that didn't happen to make the cut that I'm going to explore later. Right after this happened, there were articles all over the place in print and on the internet about how a number of parents were still there that night, the night of May 24, waiting for word on their dead child. But they had to bring in DNA. They had to do DNA tests to identify them because they were reportedly shot beyond recognition, so disfigured, the authorities said, that they couldn't even identify them. And the parents were like, what? Huh? And because if you think about it, John, a school is someplace where the same kids go there every day. There's a relatively limited number of people there. And so by the process of elimination alone, narrowing things down, and by what teachers know in terms of recognizing a kid's attire or clothing or any other part, shoes, you name it, to say that they were shot beyond recognition and they needed DNA tests to even identify who they were is categorically not a believable thing.
Yeah, I know. There's so many things that are unbelievable about this official narrative relating to the school shooting. That's probably one of the top ones.
Right, right. And so when you think about parents being told that, and some of the things I read were some uncles or aunts or relatives or parents kind of believed what they were told when they were told that. That's really hard to believe. You know, the idea was, well, they're too disfigured. It's too terrible to show you. But not only is it too terrible to show you, it's so bad that we can't even identify them without a DNA test. If that were my kid, heads would roll if anybody even attempted to tell me something that absurd. There is no way that I would settle for something like that, nor should anyone in Uvalde. This country has got to get beyond this notion that questioning these things deeply is an affront or an assault on those that died reportedly or those that survived. It is not. The truth is never an affront. The truth is never an assault. The truth is what sets us free. And the truth might be very bitter. You might learn some things you wish you didn't know, but nothing short of the truth is ever going to free this country from this torrent of reported school shootings or church shootings or grocery store shootings, all of which have some sort of anomalies or opaque parts of it. Some of them are entirely opaque or very, very difficult to believe. Logic is out the window. And there's so many things one could say about this. I'll mention something that's also not in my story. The Uvalde County Justice of the Peace, Eulalio Lalo Diaz Jr., said, and this was back on June 1st, all 21 victims, 19 kids and two staffers, teachers, were sent to the medical examiner's office in San Antonio for autopsies, which he said is standard. But there was one surviving parent that wondered why the 11-year-old daughter, Layla, why her body was missing for so long. That came along much later. And so all the bodies were taken out of there, out of the Uvalde area. People can draw what conclusions they want from that. Is it irregular? Is it not? But here's the strange thing. There's not a word on the funeral or whereabouts of the body of the accused shooter, Salvador Ramos, 18 years old. Not a word about what happened to him. And I'm not saying he deserves a 21-gun salute or honors. I'm going to call him the accused or, you know, reported shooter. But one would think that if they knew that 21 bodies were sent to San Antonio for autopsies, and I would ask the question, why an autopsy if you know that the cause of death is gunfire, unless you want to know a lot of ballistics and bullet patterns, why wouldn't we know whether the shooter's body was autopsied, where he went, where he is buried, what happened to him? I looked at a lot of funeral home websites, and it looked like several of the funerals did in fact happen. Whether they were open or closed casket was not always made clear, but we know nothing or next to nothing about the accused shooter. And what the mass media cartel is talking about, and now I'm getting into what I did write about, is everything is about the police botching this and failing to protect the kids. And of course, that is a very serious issue. But what the mass media cartel is doing in the process, John, is they're upholding the standard narrative. Yes, yes, the police misbehaved. Yes, they didn't act when they should have. They really failed in this. But the story is true. Salvador Ramos, just turned 18, was able to afford over $5,000 to buy hundreds of rounds of ammunition, magazines, protective gear, and he bought it. He bought both guns within about a week before the shooting. He had just turned 18 on May 16th, and he had the confidence and the competence to operate these firearms so effectively that some kids could be shot beyond recognition and would need DNA testing. And how did this burger-flipping high school dropout afford all that war material, as they're calling it? And how did he achieve such competency with the firearms so quickly? Did anyone ever see him at a shooting range or somewhere else practicing with these guns? Did they hear anything? Why was the Border Patrol so directly involved? I'm told that a lot of Border Patrol people had kids in there. Uvalde is about 70, 80 miles from the border. But when you do things by the book, usually the Border Patrol would not be involved unless there's border issues. Now, maybe there's exceptions, but it's still a pertinent question. And then another biggie is when Ramos wrecked what looked to be the truck he drove, the Ford F-150, and now the license plate number we've got, and I believe that's FKN-5522, Frank, well, I'd have to look it up. But at any rate, I'll get back to that in a minute. But he crashed the sort of dark gray full cab F-150 Ford, looks to be about a 2009 model or so, into this concrete lined, kind of like a drainage ditch, about 100 yards or so from the door that he went into. And he crashed it so hard that you can see that he broke both wheels, not just the tires flattened, but actually broke the wheels right off their axle, John, on the driver's side, the front left and the back left on the driver's side. And that's a lot of impact. It's not easy to break the wheel of an F-150. I've driven an F-150 for a lot of years, and they are very sturdy trucks. You don't just break a wheel on those things unless you do something pretty radical. And you can also see through photos that the airbag evidently went off, because you can see the deflated airbag. But here's the thing, John. Outside the passenger door, and I didn't see this right away, is an AR-15 barrel, a gun, just laying there, and it was just left there on top of like a gunny sack, some sort of a bag or backpack, just left there, unattended. Nobody did anything with it. And that's very clear in a photo that I can share for the AFP website. If you want me to put that with the podcast posting, we can. I might suggest that we do. But these are the things. They're focused on police failures, but there's all this stuff that's just right there, hidden in plain sight. All these questions just lingering like low-hanging fruit. And why were the police chasing Ramos before the shooting ever happened? Because that's why he crashed the truck. He was in a chase. Yeah, he had those hard-to-believe Facebook postings. I'm going to shoot my grandmother. I shot my grandmother. Now I'm going to a school. Nobody has ever seen those Facebook posts, John. They are an article of faith. And we're supposed to take the authority's word for it that he wrote those things. And now that might explain maybe why, or at least partially explain why there was a chase that led to the school. And that means that there were cops there, several of them, right when he arrived. You see, and they already knew he was trouble before he ever opened fire or before he ever entered that school. Now, these questions are not going to go away, okay? Because we're not going to let him go away. What did they know about Ramos or whoever was driving that truck? I don't mean to be so Sherlock Holmesy, but that's just the way I think. What did they know about him before the bullets started flying in the school? That's the real question to the police. That's the question that all the mass media, which are pounding on the police for their failure, that's the questions and all these questions that the mass media will not answer, or excuse me, will not ask, let alone answer. And so you see, it's like a limited hangout. Let's beat on the police for their failures, but not let's not ask any of these other questions that I've just listed. And there are many more.
Yeah, I gotta say, it's such a bizarre scenario, such a bizarre situation. I was looking at a Texas Tribune timeline of events leading up to the shooting, and then certainly on the day of the shooting, they have it broken down. I mean, almost minute by minute of the day that this allegedly happened. And they were claiming, and this is, you know, kind of a, like the big story now, is that there were actually police officers in the school shortly after, you know, the alleged gunman entered, and yet they just failed to to do anything. Chief Pete Arredondo, he actually works for the school. He was the school district police chief, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah,
he was the school district police.
Right, yeah. Right, and so he shows up, and along with three other officers, he apparently did not bring his radio with him. I mean, what is that about? That makes no sense. I mean, how do you not have your radio with you? Aren't cops trained to always have their radio on them so they can communicate with their fellow officers and, of course, back to headquarters? So none of this basically makes any sense. And again, they're sitting there, essentially watching this happen, waiting for a key to enter the classroom. I mean, it's so bizarre.
It is, and that's part of the mass media's main line of inquiry. And I'm not saying it's an unworthy line of inquiry, but what I am saying is it's way too limited. The broad brushstrokes that we're giving it are what the people of Uvalde actually deserve. This creates a limited hangout thing where they can keep hammering on this narrative and avoid all of these other things. But while you're on the topic, there was supposed to have been a special kind of axe there that firemen use to break open doors when they need to. And that was readily available, we're told. And also they can simply shoot the door open. And then they say, well, he was barricaded in there. But then they admitted, if I'm not mistaken, that the doors were not locked in those classrooms that were told 111 and 112. Although initially they made it sound like one classroom. Suddenly it was two. I think they had to, you know, figure out a way to explain the fact that it was not only 21 reportedly killed, but 17 wounded, which totals 38, with 38 being one classroom or two. Well, the narrative went from one classroom to two, rooms 111 and 112. But if the doors were not locked and he had nothing in front of the doors, and I don't know if the doors open out or in, I suppose in, then he couldn't have been barricaded in there, because to be barricaded in there, you'd have to have the doors to where you cannot enter, either locked or blocked. So they're saying evidently it was neither once, and they still use the word barricaded. Well, no, he wasn't barricaded. I mean, all you had to do was open the door and blow him away. I mean, if he would have been a single gun owner somewhere in some compound called Waco, let's say, they wouldn't have had any trouble taking him out, would they, John?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's very bizarre. Well, right now, if I'm not mistaken, there's a state legislative investigation taking place right now. Is that right? And they're having hearings on it. Boy, right. That would be interesting to sit down and watch some of these proceedings and just hear what these guys have to say. Of course, it's going to be excuse after excuse after excuse. I was reading some of the comments of the Chief Arredondo, and, you know, it's just one excuse after another for why this happened and why he couldn't do more. You know, so of course there's going to, I highly doubt there's going to be any accountability. I frankly question the legitimacy of this narrative, whether or not this even happened the way they say it did. I don't know if that, you know, I don't know what happened, but what they're reporting certainly does not add up, I think, in many people's minds that are actually thinking about this critically.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of stating it. We don't know exactly what happened, but what we're told happened doesn't hold water. So we're not jumping to conclusions. We're asking for more data. And here's a good parting comment as we wrap up. The Texas Tribune and the Austin American Statesman, in association with KVU TV out of Austin, KVUE, they call it KVU. Those entities, KVU and the Austin American Statesman newspaper, are in a partnership, plus the Texas Tribune, which is a nonprofit. They claim to have seen video footage that the rest of us have never seen. And we have to take their word for it. As I note in this reporting in AFP this week, we have to take their word for it that they have gotten data from the police about police communications, apparent transcripts of sorts, plus this exclusive video footage that only they have seen. We have to take their word for it on the interpretation of the video footage and the other data. But out of the other side of their mouth, they've been saying, as I reported here, that the Texas authorities, by and large, are closing ranks and are not allowing or not releasing the data on the Uvalde school shooting. So they're talking out both sides of their mouth. If they're not releasing data, then where'd they get the data?
Yeah, right. And you would think that there would be all sorts of surveillance footage, body cam footage, which, if I'm not mistaken, there have been Freedom of Information Act requests filed with some of these agencies, right, to obtain this information. But thus far, they've been pretty hesitant to release anything. Is that right?
Yeah, the claim was, or the narrative was, that under Texas law, there is a exception if the accused shooter is not going to trial, and that could be because they're dead, which is reportedly the case here, and information does not have to be provided to the courts or to attorneys, defense attorneys, prosecutors, that the police and the authorities, but the Texas authorities in general, have a rationale and a reason to withhold the data. It's a loophole in the law. And a lot of the agencies can simply appeal to the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, and say, do we really have to release this data to the press or public? This isn't going to trial. Why do we have to do this? And as I understand it, there's plenty of leeway for them to withhold the data for those reasons. But I would argue that due to the apparent seriousness of this event, if what we're told is true, and with all the unanswered questions to the parents and other relatives, my argument is that transcends the state's prerogatives to withhold data in this case, precisely because the police failed so badly and so miserably, apparently, and because of all the unanswered questions that we've posed that the press will not pose. It's just too serious of a matter to simply say, well, just because the accused shooter is not going to trial, then we can disregard everyone else and everything else, and we can just withhold this. I don't think that's going to wash with the people of Uvalde. And I just, as I ended one of my stories this week, Uvalde officials hiding the truth, I put it this way. The mass media's selective framing of the issue hopefully will not set the parameters of the state legislative probe on this thing. The state legislative probe led by Representative Dustin Burroughs, a state rep out of the Lubbock area. He's a Republican. And here's what I put. The bewildered people of Uvalde, who are not altogether buying the official story, need a real investigation, not grandstanding, and ultra-detailed police reports complete with photos and charts should be expected, nay, demanded, without redactions. So, you know, I want to know where all the spent shells fell. I want a chart of that. I want a chart of where all the bodies were. I want to see photos. Everything, no redactions. They have to prove this thing happened. This is the thing. Here's the real clincher, John. The burden of proof is not on the people. The burden of proof is on the authorities to prove their narrative and what they say happened really happened. 100% on their shoulders. Always has been, always will be.
Yes, sir. Well said, Mark. Well, we'll go ahead and wrap up with that. Yeah, this is a story that's not going away. I'm sure we'll have more updates on it in the future. And I would just encourage everybody to check out AmericanFreePress.net to subscribe to the newspaper. If you are not already, you can find subscription details right on the website. And one last plug, we also have a Rumble channel that you can access. Right, you know, if you just go right to AmericanFreePress.net, you'll see the AFP video now on Rumble box right there at the top on the right-hand side of the page. If you click that, that'll take you right to our Rumble channel. Mark, you've been doing some interesting videos for the Rumble channel, so keep up the good work, and we'll do this again in the future.
Thanks, John. One parting comment, derived from what I just said, and I wouldn't make it unless it was really important. The fact that the parents and other relatives are asking a lot of questions in and of itself is really healthy and really good. This is the first mass shooting as it's defined for us. The first one where the people in general are asking some very hard questions. Most of these things have been sort of paraded through, and anyone that asks questions is absolutely demonized right away. That's not the case here. This school was surrounded by a lot of residences and businesses, and everything was within eyeshot on two sides of the four sides of that school building, Robb Elementary. People saw in real time a lot of what was going on, and they're not just upset, they're intellectually involved, they're asking questions. It's really healthy, and that ultimately is going to be what I think will be the turning point. So we'll leave it with that.
Right. All right, Mark. Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it. You enjoy your weekend, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, John. Great stuff.
Okay. Bye-bye.